This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on running an online business. I am joined by barrister Mr. Tim Sampson from Lamb Chambers in London. Tim is a senior barrister who is regularly instructed to deal with disputes in the High Court, and he also works on serious disputes in the County Court. Additionally, Tim lectures and writes on specialist areas of the law, and he has taught on professional training courses run by the BPP University. Thank you very much for joining me, Tim.
Good morning.
And it is a lovely morning outside, actually. I think we're at the tail end of hanging on to the last bits of summer. So running an online business, yes, I mean, in this podcast, we hope to highlight the key issues that running an online business, for anybody, you know, they need to take some of these things into consideration. And I was just saying to you, Tim, wasn't I, that since lockdown happened in March this year, 2020, just from family and friends, there's so many people around me saying, oh, I'm doing this online, oh, I'm doing that online. And people are engaging with either giving just simple stuff like exercise classes or yoga classes or selling stuff. It's out there. It's happening a lot.
Well, the world has clearly changed. It was already changing, and that we've had a shove from the COVID pandemic, and there's no going back now. But that means a lot of businesses are maybe focusing on their online content far more than they were even a few months ago. And the value then of their websites and their trading platforms online suddenly becomes critical to the business. In lockdown, it was the only way for many businesses to conduct business. So you have to think, right, what is it I need from my website or need to do in relation to my website to actually create a functional business that I can get value out of and retain the value? Because there are two aspects of what we're going to look at today. The first is essentially the intellectual infrastructure of the website, what your branding goes into it, what your copyright goes into it, domain names, we'll look at AdWords. That's your shop front. But then you're also dealing with consumers. And if you're not used to dealing with consumers in an online environment, you may not appreciate the subtle difference between that and a face-to-face transaction and the regulations that apply to dealing with consumers through a website, basically selling to people at a distance.
Yes.
The terminology that the law uses.
I think you're absolutely right, Tim. I mean, I have to say, I used to shop online anyway, but since lockdown, everything is happening online, certainly in my household, and more people that have never actually done anything online are doing stuff online. The Mail Online recently reported how lockdown has inspired a generation of independent businesses. But I think you're absolutely right in saying that, you know, since the lockdown and since life has changed due to COVID, businesses may, I think they all sort of in some shape or form had online presence, but have never geared up as much as they have done to be able to continue doing business, change the way they're doing business. Even simple things, actually, like the DVLA, where you used to complete a document to retain a number plate and send it in and do all of that. All of a sudden, I had to do that the other week, and it was all online. And it was really efficient, which was brilliant.
It is. And even people like me can use it.
Well, look. Go ahead.
The websites. Obviously, most of the websites are not going to be highly functional. Well, not really what we're looking at in this podcast, where you've gone out to a website designer and asked them to write substantial portions of code for you so your website can do something clever and then maybe sell things. For example, a website like The Train Line, which collects data on train timetables and then prices tickets and sells it to you. There's an underlying software there that was expensive to create. And there are important copyright issues with regards to outsourcing the purchase of code to do things on your website. Because you may think, well, I went to that coder and I asked them to do X for me. They've written the code, they've given it to me, but now I realize I actually don't own it. Because unless I took an assignment of the copyright in the copyright remains with the person that wrote it. So it's an easy trap to fall into, that you've bought expensive functionality through a code that you don't actually own any rights
I guess that doesn't matter if you're just getting a website designed perhaps that lots of other people have got and you just want the similar sort of website. But I guess it really would matter if you're getting something done that's bespoke to your business and unique, and you want to own those rights of having that. So your website designer, perhaps, not that I'm saying website designers do, but couldn't sit there and say, oh, that's done really well, that's really profitable, why don't I duplicate that as a business, or why don't I tell so-and-so to duplicate it? But we hear a lot about intellectual property rights in relation to websites. But what are the key ones, Tim? You know, someone carrying out online business, what are the key points that somebody to be looking to protect from the outset, would you say?
Well, from my perspective, any business, the brand name, the company name is critical. It's not simply important with websites in terms of having a name that will distinguish you from your competitors and marks your little bit of territory out as your company, but also, of course, your domain name is your link to the world. Therefore, it's vital that you have absolutely secured not only the brand name for the company, but also you can get the domain name, because if you can't link the domain name and the branding of the company, you're not going to go anywhere very fast. I mean, it shouldn't be a problem, but never get involved in a situation where you have, and I've come across this with companies where they've got brilliant ideas for branding and not checked the availability of domain names.
Oh, but do people seriously still do that? Because checking a domain name surely should be the first thing on the list, right? Before you say that's a good company name, because the other thing you need to check is that somebody else doesn't own it.
And there's no excuse, because the online resources available, Companies House, the UK IPO, you can check company names, you can check registered trademarks. If you want a European dimension, you can go to the European Intellectual Property Office. There's no difficulty in checking who's got what. The only issues you may face are in respect of unregistered branding, which still, of course, exists in large measure in this country. You've got the rights in what's called passing off, which is the goodwill in a company name. And, of course, it's very much harder to find who may have goodwill in a brand name if it's not registered somewhere. But I'm afraid that's a bridge you'll just have to cross. But in terms of what you can do to protect yourself, make sure when you register a company name or pick a company name for your website, it is a registered trademark. You register the domain names. And in fact, it's not a bad idea to register one or two similar domain names that prevents anyone else getting hold of them. Not that they actually are technically entitled to them. It could be seen as what's called an instrument of fraud to have someone a domain name that is suspiciously similar to somebody else's. But of course, the pain comes in having to take it back off them later when they've caused a nuisance with it. So for the minimal cost of registering domain names, for example, a hyphenated version of your company name, if it's got two elements rather than just all one word, just some simple things like that, you can protect yourself for minimal additional cost.
Or, for example, you know, you buy the .com and you think, oh, I don't need .co.uk or I don't need .eu. And then, unfortunately, somebody can go along and buy the .co.uk or the .whatever if you haven't purchased it. And I mean, it is a bit like how long is a piece of string, because I've bought domain names before. And when you go on to buy a domain name, it kind of gives you the .so-and-so, as in .co.uk, .eu, .aus, .this, .that. And you think, God, you know, by the time you tot it all up, it does add up. But then I think it's really important to think, well, if you're aiming to have start a business online, or you've started a business online which is going to be quite big, or you want it to be quite predominant out there in the market, then it is really worth buying as many of the common dot bits that you can to protect yourself from anybody else, as you said, Tim, buying it, passing off as you, or create, you know, causing your business some damage by trying to make out as if they, you know, link to you.
You get the common problem is simply diversion of trade. You don't even realise for a time that someone is operating under a domain name that's very similar to your own. And all you notice is business is dropping off. So it's definitely worth doing that. And the same applies really to AdWords and meta tags. If you think you've got key brand words that you want linked to your website, then it's worth registering them to make sure that when those words get typed into a search engine, it directs the consumer to your website and nobody else's. And what people forget is that AdWords are available to anybody. It doesn't have to be an owner of a brand right. So if you can jump in and take a name that you notice you want that hasn't been registered as an AdWord by a brand owner, then you're allowed to have it. You can't use it to falsely represent that you are that brand owner, but you can direct them away to your website as long as there's no trademark infringement going on or question of passing off. But that doesn't need to be the case. All they're doing is redirecting your potential customers to themselves.
Yeah.
So if you've got key branding terms that you want, then get them registered as AdWords or any form of meta tag that will direct web traffic in your direction.
I think the last point that we want to mention on this question, Tim, is about copyright notices for websites, because I can't tell you how many websites I've been onto that don't have that. And I think that's one of the most simplest things to think about. It should be, right?
It's a simple. You don't legally actually have to say this is my copyright, but it makes life an awful lot easier asserting a right later in the contents of a website if you've asserted that right front and centre on the website. And all a copyright notice is simply says, this is the owner of the copyright and a date from which you assert the copyright. And it couldn't be simpler. So, yes, I would always recommend copyright notices. And any website that doesn't have a proper copyright notice is either running the risk of people helping themselves to the content illicitly, or it might suggest that website is not actually entirely legitimate because they're not prepared to assert they actually own the copyright in what they're displaying. And of course, there are plenty of websites out there for companies that are not wholly legitimate.
Oh, goodness gracious. That's a great question. I like the way you put that, Tim. I really like the way you put that, but that's absolutely right. I mean, I've seen a few myself. In fact, I have seen websites that have been copied to look exactly like a brand or a business that I would actually go regularly to. They've sent me emails and I think it's the company that I've bought from before. I click on the email and I think, and I'm looking at it and I'm browsing and I think, oh, and then it's little things that just give it away. When you're looking carefully, you think, this isn't the same company. This isn't the same business that I've bought something from before. I've actually almost got trapped from buying from a fake business that's tried to pass off as another business. But I mean, just for the independent seller, I mean, platforms like eBay, Amazon and Shopify, they're making it so easy now, aren't they, to just set up a business online and sell online. And I mean, I guess we're not talking about somebody who's just using eBay as a platform or, you know, Shopify or Amazon just as their platform. This is if you're setting up a website to be able to sell and do business online. So, I mean, what must an owner of a website, a business website, do to comply with the laws of selling online? What are the sort of top two or three points that somebody should consider?
Right. Well, you can imagine the situation when you walk into the shop, you make your purchase, you're talking to the salesperson, you've seen the goods, they're in your hands, you leave the shop, you've paid for them, the contract's been made and performed. But obviously, if you're buying online, there's a different paradigm. What you want to know, or what you're entitled to know is more important, is if you're dealing with someone at a distance, and a website is what one of the key ways you will be dealing at a distance.
And that's what we mean by distance selling. So distance selling means buying or engaging in a service online.
But not just online, but where the customer and the seller are physically separated.
Right. Not in the same room or building, for example.
Well, for example, the TV channels that sell goods and services, and you can go to them, there are numerous TV channels of that type. That's a form of distance selling, because they're saying to consumers, buy this lovely, shiny bit of jewellery at this price. And that's a distance selling relationship. But we're just thinking about online here. And what is required is that through your platform, the consumer is entitled to know who you are, the name of the business, where you are physically located, all the information to get hold of you easily, and of course, if you are a front for a third-party company, are you acting as a representative for somebody else, or are you trading on your own account? And then, of course, you're entitled to know what the cost of the goods is you're going to be purchasing in full, or if you can't give an exact price, how that price is reached. And the same for the cost of delivery. Either it costs £5 to deliver in the UK, or there's a mechanism to calculate the cost of delivery to you. So it's the core information that has to be provided in a permanent medium, which can include emails, is identity of the seller, where you can get hold of them.
Contact details, yeah.
They're actually representing anybody else. Because, of course, you can imagine the situation where you buy something online or through a website, and then you realise you don't actually have any mechanism to get hold of the people when you want to complain.
I cannot tell you that has happened to me on more than one occasion, I have to say. I don't know if it's ever happened to you, but I have bought online and then there's no contact details whatsoever. Can't get hold of anyone. Nothing.
Well, that, of course, is in flagrant breach of the regulations. If you are a business owner, you do have to look at the relevant regulations. And I know we try and avoid too much black letter law on these podcasts, but the Consumer Contracts Information Cancellation and Additional Charges Regulations 2013.
That's a bit of a mouthful, Tim, I have to say. Goodness gracious.
They are worth reading if you are an online trader, for the simple fact that the obligations that you need to follow, in particular in terms of customer information, are just set out line by line in Schedule 2.
Right, so hold on a moment here. If somebody doesn't have that information on their website and you've had a bad experience buying from them, or you've had a customer who's had a bad experience and they just don't have their contact details, they haven't been clear about the total cost, i.e. they've stuck a nice little charge at the bottom of the cost of the item, which you was not expecting, and because you paid by card, it sucked the money out of your payment method. What can a consumer do about it? Who do they go to? Where do you complain about an online business that's not carrying out its business and adhering to these simple points that we're talking about today?
Well, your first port of call is probably going to be trying to get hold of the company itself. But of course, if there's no contact details, no physical address to send things to, my first point would be, don't do any business with that company.
Let's assume you've done business, you've used a service or you've bought something and you just can't get hold of them anywhere. Where can you go? Where do you start to complain?
It's with great difficulty. Because you're saying, I have a contract with this business, quotes unquote, but you can't identify to anyone who the business is. It's sometimes possible to do a check on the domain name. Sometimes the domain names will be a clue to who the true owner of the business is. There are various government sites you can complain to about a business, but they're not going to recover your money for you.
Yes. I think it's probably a small claim. If you need to recover money, you go online money claim or something. I think that's probably going to be the right way.
For the claim, where do you go?
Yes.
So the consumer also needs to equip themselves with a little bit of common sense and think, I don't know who this person is. They've given me no information about the business as such, other than there's a website here. Should I be doing business with them? Should I be giving them my money? Is there something a little suspicious here?
The other thing is, Tim, is when, for example, you've, you know, they've put they've put false information on about their contact details or their registered office or their trading address. And then if you're left high and dry, you know, it's goodness, because you're absolutely right. If you don't have the contact details, you can't even issue a claim to get your money back, not even via the online money claim service, which is a very, you know, for stuff for £10,000 and less, for any claim that's of that value.
Of course, I suspect one of the problems is one of the ways firms get away with this is that most consumers don't think to themselves, well, what am I entitled to expect from a website? And of course, the other key element of a legitimately run business online is your ability to cancel the order and return goods, because an honest business has no problem complying with the regulations about having a cancellation policy. So again, if you can't find that on the website, you've got to think, is this acceptable? And of course, if you are a legitimate business, you must have a cancellation policy, unless you fall into one of the exempted areas, of which most businesses are not going to fall into. Yes. They're not the sort of thing that a small online business is going to be involved in, like gambling or selling real property. Those aren't transactions.
Yes, I'd like to see a cancellation policy on gambling.
Or if you are involved in, say, advertising properties for sale, you're not a small business. No one's going to transact that sort of put that sort of transaction to an unknown website, because you're dealing with a lot of money. So in terms of having a cancellation policy, which you can find, it's the sort of thing a consumer should ask themselves. What happens if I want to cancel this contract? Not because the goods are defective or the services aren't going to be exactly what I want. I've just decided I wanted to cancel. Well, you have, under the regulations, a complete right to cancel your delivery of goods or the provision of services.
We've actually spoke about that, haven't we, on another podcast, consumer goods, which is really interesting.
Yes, we can go back and I'd want to go back and look at all those issues. But of course, there is a basic principle that if you receive the goods and you decide, no, I don't want them, you've got 14 days to return them. If you've signed up for services and you suddenly said, actually, I don't want these services, with certain exceptions, you've got 14 days to cancel. The exceptions are things like you contact an emergency plumber to come around and fix your taps because they're leaking all over the floor. You can't, 3 days after they've turned up and done the work, go, well, I had a 14-day cancellation period.
Yes.
Decided I don't want to pay for that.
Yes.
But that's sort of limited cancellation. Of course, the other area is digital downloads. And this is one where the seller has to be very careful. We've looked at it from the consumer point of view in the past.
Yes.
And the rule is that because purely digital content aren't goods, they're treated almost like a service, your right to cancel is 14 days from the date you order it. But most people want their digital content there and then. Now, if the seller says, fine, you can have your digital content there and then, that's quite possible. But the seller, as we're looking at this from the website owner's point of view now,
yes,
has to make sure, one, that the consumer has confirmed and acknowledged that they do want the digital download now, i.e. we're not going to wait 14 days so the cancellation period has expired, and critically, that the consumer understands that their cancellation right has disappeared at that point.
Yes.
So you say, I want the digital download today, within the 14-day period, they don't get a right to cancel, so they pay the goods. And for the seller, the important point is that they don't get both those things properly acknowledged by the purchaser, and they send the digital download within the 14-day cancellation period, there's no obligation on the recipient to pay for anything.
Goodness gracious. And they can say, well, sorry, but I want to cancel this. They could have already had access to the digital information and the digital download. And I can understand why, clearly, in that instance, you know, you can't have a 14-day cancellation period, because if you've had access to the digital download, you could have copied it or you've put it somewhere and then said, well, I'm cancelling, but you've already got it downloaded. My goodness. I mean, one of the interesting things I read was that according to eBay, the top 10 categories of online selling since lockdown. I've been men's clothing, top of the charts. I wouldn't have thought it would have been men's clothing, to be fair. I would have thought it was something to do with the female world. But it's men's clothing, women's clothing, speciality fashion. I'm not sure what speciality fashion means. Maybe brand names and stuff. Cycling. Now, I would have put cycling further up the list, because I tell you what, we, since lockdown, we have not bought so much stuff for our bicycles, even bicycles, than ever before. Cars and parts, mobile phone accessories, fitness, running and yoga stuff, swimming pools and hot tubs. That's an interesting one. I mean, we bought a swimming pool, but it was about $19.99 from Amazon for my three-year-old. That was the pool. And then DIY materials. And the last one was facial skincare. So, interesting list of top 10, according to eBay, for online selling. But that's all we've got time for today, Tim.
Right. Well, I think we'll have to be back for part two of this one, because I think we've got a long list of questions we still need to address.
This is the first time I got stuck. You know, we didn't quite make it over number two, but that's good, because what that means is that we've given lots of information on each section of what we've tried to discuss. But it is really interesting, isn't it? And I do think that, you know, you shouldn't just think, oh, I'm going to set up an online business selling this and there you go, because you can build your website yourself quite quickly. There's so many platforms, aren't there, that you can just build on. You can set up taking money online quite quickly as well. That, again, there's platforms.
So, I think we, you know, there's a responsibility on those building the websites and running the business to comply with the regulations. Obviously, they have to do that. But maybe there's also, we should turn this around, consumers ought to be better informed as to their rights and the expectations they should have when dealing with companies online. Because I suspect most people give it not a moment's thought.
No.
And if they actually did think, they don't have to go away and read the regulations. There's plenty of simple
information. Well, thank goodness for that, Tim.
But if they understood that a legitimate business will provide them with information about the name, the locality, contact details, complaints and returns policies, if you don't see those things, don't do business with them.
No.
But most people just get the irresistible urge to buy the thing that's in front of them on the screen without thinking, do I really, really want to do business with this fairly obviously woolly looking company that I can't quite work out who they are? But anyway, that's for another day.
No, I get it. I totally get it. And to be honest, we've outlined some really simple things that as a seller, as somebody selling a service or a product online, you can think about during this podcast. And we will certainly do a part two, because I think, as you said, there's so much to think about. And I also think that as time evolves, and some people might continue selling online. I mean, what's been really interesting is I've read reports that people have set up businesses online thinking, I'll just do this during the lockdown, or it's just something to do with my time. And actually, they've turned out to be quite profitable and quite good. So, you know, there's people out there, I'm sure, that have not entirely intended to do online business for the next few years. But for them, it looks like it's a great way forward. But yeah, thank you very much, Tim. Thank you for your time today. What I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.